Side 4. Eideru by William Gibson. Continuing on page 153. 22. Gomi Boy. The train's more crowded now, standing room only, everyone pressed in tight, and somehow the eye contact rules were different here, but she wasn't sure how. Her bag with the sand vendors was jammed up against Masahiko's back. He was looking at the control face again, holding it up the way a commuter would hold a strategically folded newspaper. On their way back to Mitsuko's father's restaurant, and then she didn't know what. She'd done the thing that Hiromi hadn't wanted her to do, and got nothing for it but a vaguely unpleasant idea of Rez as someone capable of being boring. And where did it leave her? She'd gone ahead and used Kelsey's cash card to pay for the train, and now another train back. And Zona had said somebody was looking for her. They could track her when she used the cash card. Maybe there was a way to cash it in, but she doubted it. None of this had gone the way she'd tried to imagine it back in Seattle. But then you couldn't be expected to imagine anyone like Mary Alice, could you? Or Eddie, or even Hiromi. Masahiko frowned at the control face. Chia saw the dots and squiggles changing. That thing Mary Alice had stuck in her bag, right here under her arm. She should have left it at Mitsuko's. Or thrown it away, but then what would she say if Eddie or Mary Alice showed up? What if it was full of drugs? In Singapore, they hung people right in the mall for that. Her father didn't like it, and he said that was one of the reasons he never invited her there. They put it on television, too, so that it was really hard to avoid seeing it, and he didn't want her to see it. Now she wondered how far Singapore was from Tokyo. She wished she could go there and keep her eyes closed until she was in her father's apartment, and never turn the TV on, just be there with him and smell his shaving smell, and put her face against his scratchy wool shirt. Except she guessed he didn't wear those in Singapore because it was hot there. She'd keep her eyes closed anyway, and listen to him talk about his work, about the arbitrage engines shuttling back and forth through the world's markets like invisible dragons, fast as light, shaving fragments of advantage for traders like her father. Masahiko turned, accidentally knocking her bag aside as the train stopped at a station. Not theirs. A woman with a yellow shopping bag said something in Japanese. Masahiko took Chia's wrist and pulled her toward the open door.
This isn't where we get off.
Come, come. Out onto the platform. A different smell here. Something chemical and sharp. The walls not so clean somehow. A broken tile in the ceramic ceiling.
What's the matter? Why are we getting off?
He pulled her into the corner formed by the tiled wall and a huge vending machine.
Someone is at the restaurant, waiting for you.
He looked down at her wrist, as if amazed to find that he was holding it, and instantly released her.
How do you know?
Walled City. There have been inquiries in the last hour.
Who?
Russians.
Russians?
There are many from the Combinat here since the earthquake. They forge relationships with the Gumi.
What's Gumi?
Mafia, you call it. Yakuza. My father has arrangement with local Gumi, necessary in order to operate restaurant. Gumi representative spoke about you to my father.
Your neighborhood mafia is Russian?
Behind his head, on the side of the machine, the animated logo of something called Apple Shires.
No. Yamaguchi Gumi franchise. My father knows these men. They tell my father Russians ask about you and this is not good. They cannot guarantee usual safety. Russians not reliable.
I don't know any Russians,
Chia said.
We go now.
Where?
He led her along the crowded platform, its pavement wet from hundreds of furled umbrellas. It must be raining now, she thought. Toward an escalator.
When Walled City saw attention was being paid to our addresses, my sister's and mine, a friend was sent to remove my computer.
Why?
Because I have responsibility. For Walled City.
Distributed processing.
You've got a mud in your computer?
Walled City is not anywhere,
he said, as they stepped onto the escalator.
My friend has my computer, and he knows about men who are waiting for you.
Masahiko said his friend was called Gomi Boy. He was very small, and wore an enormous balloon-bottomed pair of padded fatigue pants covered with at least a dozen pockets. These were held up with 3-inch-wide day-glow orange suspenders over a ratty cotton sweater with the cuffs rolled back. His shoes were pink and looked like the shoes babies wore, but bigger. He was perched on an angular aluminum chair now, and the baby shoes didn't quite touch the floor. His hair looked as though it had been sculpted with a spatula, gleaming swirls and dips, like your hand might stick there if you touched it. It was the way they painted J.D. Shapley's hair on those murals in Pioneer Square, and Chia knew from school that had something to do with that whole Elvis thing, though she couldn't remember exactly what. He was talking with Masahiko in Japanese over the crashing sound surf of this gaming arcade. Chia wished she was wearing a translator, but she'd have to open her bag, find one, turn the sandbenders on. And Gomi Boy looked like he'd be just as happy knowing she couldn't understand him. He was drinking a can of something called Pocari Sweat and smoking a cigarette. Chia watched the blue smoke settling out in layers in the air, lit by the glare of the games. There was cancer in that, and they'd arrest you in Seattle if you did it. Gomi Boy's cigarette looked like it had been made in a factory, a perfect white tube with a brown tip he put to his lips. Chia had seen those in old movies sometimes, the ones they hadn't gone through yet to digitally erase them, but the only other cigarettes she'd seen were the twisted-up paper ones they sold on the street in Seattle, or you could buy a little baggie of the tobacco stuff and the white squares of paper to roll it up in. Meshbacks in school did it. The rain was still coming down. Through the arcade's streaming window, she could make out another arcade across the street, one of the ones with the machines the silver balls poured through. The neon and the rain and the silver balls ran all together, and she wondered what Masahiko and Gomi Boy were talking about. Gomi Boy had Masahiko's computer in a plaid plastic carry bag with quilted pink international biohazard symbols on the sides. It was sitting on the little table beside the can of Pocari Sweat. What was a Pocari? She imagined a kind of wild pig with bristles, turned-up tusks, like she'd seen on the Nature Channel. Gomi Boy sucked on his cigarette, making the end glow. He squinted through the smoke at Masahiko and said something. Masahiko shrugged. There was a fresh mini-can of microwaved espresso in front of him, and Chia had another Coke Light. In Tokyo, there was nowhere to sit down unless you bought something, and it was quicker to buy a drink than something to eat, and it cost less. Except she wasn't paying for these. Gomi Boy was, because he and Masahiko didn't want her to use Kelsey's cash card. Gomi Boy spoke again. "He wishes to talk with you," Masahiko said. Chia bent over, unzipped her bag, found the ear clips. She only had the two, so she handed one to Gomi Boy, put the other on herself, and hit power. He put his on. "I am from Walled City," he said. "You understand? A MUD, right? Multi-user domain. Not in the sense you mean, but approximately, yes. Why are you in Tokyo?" "To gather information about Reza's plan to marry the Aidoru, Rei Toei." Gomi Boy nodded. Being an otaku was about caring a lot about information. He understood being a fan. "Do you have dealings with the Combine?" Chia knew he had said Combinat, and the translator had covered it. He meant that mafia government in Russia. "No," Chia said. "And you came to be in Masahiko's because..." "Mitsuko's the social secretary of the Tokyo chapter of the low-res group I belong to in Seattle." "How many times did you port from the restaurant?"
"3 times."
The Silkamarie Kolb outfit, the meeting, Zona Rosa. "I paid for presentation software. Mitsuko and I did the meeting. I linked home." "You paid for the software with your cash card?"
"Yes."
She looked from Gomi Boy to Masahiko. Between and behind them, the rain. The endless racketing cascade of the little silver balls through the glass across the street. Players hunched there on integral stools, manipulating the flood of metal. Masahiko's expression told her nothing at all. "Masahiko's computer maintains certain aspects of Walled City," Gomi Boy said. "Contingency plans were in place for its removal to safety. When it became obvious that both Masahiko's and his sister's user addresses were attracting unusual attention, I was sent to secure his machine. We frequently exchange hardware.
I am a dealer in second-hand equipment. That is why I am called Gomi Boy. I have my own keys to Masahika's room. His father knows I am allowed to enter. His father does not care. I came and took the computer. Nearby is a small civic recreation area. The restaurant is visible from it. Seeing Oakland Overbombers, I crossed the street and spoke with them.
Seeing what?
A skateboard group. They are named for the California Soccer Club. I asked them if there had been unusual activity. They told me they had seen a very large vehicle an hour before.
A Graceland.
A Daihatsu Graceland. There are fewer here than in America, I think.
Chia nodded. Her stomach did that cold flip thing again. She thought she might throw up. Gomi Boy leaned sideways with his cigarette, which was short now, and mashed the lit end into a little chrome bowl that was fastened to the side of a game console. Chia wondered what this was actually used for, and why he did that. But she supposed he had to put it somewhere, or it would burn his fingers.
The Graceland parked near the restaurant. Two men got out.
What did they look like?
Gumi representatives.
Japanese?
Yes. They went into the restaurant. The Graceland waited. After 15 minutes, they returned, got into the Graceland, and left. Masahiko's father appeared. He looked in all directions, studying the street. He took his phone from his pocket and spoke with someone. He went back into the restaurant.
Gomi Boy looked at the carry bag.
I did not want to remain in the recreation area with Masahiko's computer. I told the leader of the Overbombers I would give him a better telephone later if he would remain there and phone me if more activity occurred. The Overbombers do nothing anyway, so he agreed. I left. He phoned 20 minutes later to report a gray Honda van. The driver is Japanese, but the other three are foreigners. He thinks they are Russian.
Why?
Because they are very large and dress in a style he associates with the Combine. They are still there.
How do you know?
If they leave, he must call me. He wants his new phone.
Can I port from here? I have to talk to Air Magellan right away about changing my reservations. I want to go home.
And leave Mary Alice's package in that trash canister she could see behind Gomi Boy. You must not port, Masahiko said. You must not use the cash card. If you do, they will find you.
But what else am I supposed to do?
She said, startled by her own voice, which sounded like someone else's.
I just want to go home.
Let me see the card, Gomi Boy said.
It was in her parka with her passport and her ticket home. She took it out and handed it to him. He opened a pocket on his fatigue pants and took out a small rectangular device that seemed to be held together with multiple layers of fraying silver tape. He swiped Chia's card along a slot and peered into a peephole reader like the one on a fax beeper.
This is non-transferable and cannot be used to obtain cash. It is also very easy to trace.
My friend's pretty sure they've got the number anyway,
Chia said, thinking of Zona.
Gomi Boy began to tap the edge of the cash card on the rim of his can of Pocari Sweat. There is a place where you can use this and not be traced, he said.
Tap. Tap.
Where Masahiko could access Walled City.
Tap. Tap.
Where you could phone home.
Where's that?
A love hotel.
Tap.
Do you know what that is?
No,
Chia said. Tap. Here at the Western World. Emerging from Le Chickle's pink mosaic gullet into the start of rain, Laney saw that the stilt-walking New Logic disciple was still at his post, his animated sandwich board illuminated against the evening. As Blackwell held the door of a mini-limo for Arlie, Laney looked back at the scrolling numerals and wondered how much the planet's combined weight of human nervous tissue had increased while they'd been in the bar. Laney got in after her, noticing those Catalan sons again, the three of them, decreasing in size down her inner calf. Blackwell thunked the door behind him, then opened the front, should-have-been driver's side door, and seemed to pour himself into the car, a movement that simultaneously suggested the sliding of a ball of mercury and the settling of hundreds of pounds of liquid concrete. The car waddled and swayed as its shocks adjusted to accommodate his weight. Laney saw how the brim of Blackwell's black-waxed hat drooped low in back, but not far enough to conceal a crisscrossing of fine red welts decorating the back of his neck. Their driver, to judge by the back of his head, might have been the same one who'd driven them to Akihabara. He pulled out into the mirror image traffic. The rain was running and pooling, tugging reflected neon out of the perpendicular and spreading it in wriggly lines across sidewalk and pavement. Arlie McRae was wearing perfume, and it made Lainey wish that Blackwell wasn't there, and that they were on their way somewhere other than wherever it was they were going now, and in another city, and that quite a lot of the last 7 months of Lainey's life hadn't happened at all, or had happened differently, or maybe even as far back as Dad America and the Frenchman. But as it became more complicated, it became depressing. "I'm not sure you're going to enjoy this place," she said.
"How's that?"
"You don't seem like the type."
"Why not?"
"I could be wrong. Lots of people do enjoy it. I suppose if you take it as a very elaborate joke."
"What is it?"
"A club? Restaurant? An environment?" "If we turned up there without Blackwell, I doubt they'd let us in. Or even admit it's there." Lainey was remembering the Japanese restaurant in Brentwood, the one Kathy Torrance had taken him to.
Not Japanese-Japanese.
Owned and operated. Its theme, an imaginary Eastern European country, decorated with folk art from that country, and everyone who worked there wore native garb from that country, or else a sort of metallic gray prison outfit and these big black shoes. The men who worked there all had these haircuts, shaved high on the sides, and the women had big double braids rolled up like wheels of cheese. Lainey's entree had had all kinds of different little sausages in it, the smallest he'd ever seen, and some kind of pickled cabbage on the side, and it hadn't tasted like it had come from anywhere in particular, but maybe that was the point. And then they'd gone back to her apartment, decorated like a sort of deluxe version of the cage at Slitscan. And that hadn't worked out either, and sometimes he wondered whether that had made her even angrier, when he'd gone over to out of control. "Lainey."
"Sorry. This place, Rez likes it?"
Past ambient forests of black umbrellas, waiting to cross at an intersection. "I think he just likes to brood there," she said. The Western world occupied the top two floors of an office building that hadn't quite survived the quake. Yamazaki might have said that it represented a response to trauma and subsequent reconstruction. In the days, some said hours, immediately following the disaster, an impromptu bar and disco had come into being in the former offices of a firm that had brokered shares in golf club memberships. The building, declared structurally unsound, had been sealed by emergency workers at the ground level, but it was still possible to enter through the ruined sublevels. Anyone willing to climb 11 flights of mildly fissured concrete stairs found the Western world, a bizarrely atypical, but some said, mysteriously crucial response to the upheaval that had then, so recently, killed 86,000 of the region's 36 million inhabitants. A Belgian journalist, struggling to describe the scene, had said that it resembled a cross between a permanent mass wake, an ongoing grad night for at least a dozen subcultures unheard of before the disaster, the black market cafes of occupied Paris, and Goya's idea of a dance party, assuming Goya had been Japanese and smoked freebase methamphetamine, which, along with endless quantities of alcohol, was the early Western world's substance of choice. It was, the Belgian said, as though the city in its convulsion and grief had spontaneously and necessarily generated this hidden pocket universe of the soul, its few unbroken windows painted over with black rubber aquarium paint. There would be no view of the ruptured city. As the reconstruction began around it, it had already become a benchmark in Tokyo's psychic history, an open secret, an urban legend. But now, Arlie was explaining, as they climbed the first of those 11 flights of stairs, it was very definitely a commercial operation. The damaged building owing its continued survival to the unlicensed penthouse club that was its sole occupant. If, in fact, it continued to be unlicensed, and she had her doubts about that. "There isn't a lot of slack here," she said, climbing. "Not for things like that. Everybody knows the Western world's here. I think there's a very quiet agreement somewhere to allow them to operate the place as though it were still unlicensed, because that's what people want to pay for."
"Who owns the building?" Lainey asked,
watching Blackwell float up the stairs in front of them, his arms in the matte black sleeves of the drover's coat, like sides of beef dressed for a funeral. The stairwell was lit with irregular loops of faintly bioluminescent cable.
Rumor has it one of the two groups who can't quite agree on who owns our hotel.
Mafia?
Local equivalent, but only very approximately equivalent. Real estate was baroque here before the quake. Now it's more like a cult.
Laney, glancing down as they passed one of the glowing loops, noticed on the treads of the stairs hardened trickles of something that resembled greenish amber.
There's stuff on the stairs, he said.
Urine,
Arlie said. Urine?
Solidified biologically neutral urine.
Laney took the next few steps in silence. His calves were starting to ache.
Urine?
The plumbing didn't work after the quake, she said. They couldn't use the toilets. People just started going down the stairs. Pretty horrible by all accounts, although some people actually get nostalgic about it.
It's solid?
There's a product here, a powder, looks like instant soup, some kind of enzyme. They sell it mainly to mothers with young kids. The kid has to pee, you can't get them to a toilet in time. They pee in a paper cup, an empty juice box. You drop in the contents of a handy purse-sized sachet of this stuff, zap, it's a solid. Neutral, odorless, completely hygienic. Pop it in the trash, it's landfill.
They passed another loop of light, and Laney saw miniature stalactites suspended from the edges of a step.
They used that stuff?
Lots of it. Constantly. Eventually, they had to start sawing off the buildup.
They still?
Of course not. But they kept the grotto.
Another flight. Another loop of ghostly undersea light.
What did they do about the solids?
He asked. I'd rather not know.
Winded, his ankles sore, Laney emerged from the grotto, into a black-walled and indeterminate space defined by blue light and the uprights of gilded girders. After chemically frozen frescoes of piss, the Western world disappointed. A gutted office block dressed with mismatched couches and nondescript bars. Something looming in the middle foreground. He blinked. A tank. American, he thought, and old.
How did they get that up here?
He asked Arlie, who was passing her black coat to someone. And why hadn't the floor collapsed?
It's resin, she said. Membrane sculpture. Stereolithography. Otaku thing. They bring them in sections and glue them together.
Blackwell had given up his drover's coat, exposing a garment that resembled a suit jacket, but seemed to have been woven from slightly tarnished aluminum. Whatever this fabric was, there was enough of it there for a double bedspread. He moved forward through the maze of couches and low tables, with that same effortless determination, Laney and Arlie drawn along in his wake. That's a Sherman tank, Laney said, remembering a CD-ROM from Gainesville, one about the history of armored vehicles. Arlie didn't seem to have heard him. But then she probably never played with CD-ROMs either. Time in a federal orphanage had a way of acquainting you with dead media platforms. If Arlie were right, and the Western world were being kept on as a kind of tourist attraction, Laney wondered what the crowd would have been like in the early days, when the sidewalks below were buried in 6 feet of broken glass. These people on the couches now, hunched over the low tables that supported their drinks, seemed unlike any crowd he'd seen so far in Tokyo. There was a definite edged-out quality there, and prolonged eye contact might have been interesting in some cases, dangerous in others. Distinct impression that the room's combined mass of human nervous tissue would have been found to be freighted with the odd few colorants. Or else these people were somehow pre-selected for a certain combination of facial immobility and intensity of glance.
Laney,
Blackwell said, dropping a hand on Laney's shoulder and twirling him into the gaze of a pair of long green eyes.
This is Rez. Rez, call in Laney. He's working with Arlie.
Welcome to the Western world,
smiling, and then the eyes slid past him to Arlie.
Evening, Miss McCrae.
Laney noticed something then that he knew from his encounters with celebs at Slitscan, that binary flicker in his mind between image and reality, between the mediated face and the face there in front of you.
He'd noticed how it always seemed to speed up, that alternation, until the two somehow merged, the resulting composite becoming your new idea of the person. Someone at SlitScan had told him that it had been clinically proven that celebrity recognition was handled by one particular area in the brain, but he'd never been sure whether or not they were joking. Those had been tame celebrities, the ones Kathy had already had her way with. In the building, but never the cage, to have various aspects of their public lives scripted for whatever agreements were already in place. But Rez wasn't tame, and was a much bigger deal in his own way, although Lainey had only been aware of his later career because Kathy had hated him so. Rez had his arm around Arlie now, gesturing with the other into the relative darkness beyond the Sherman tank, saying something Lainey couldn't hear.
"Mr. Lainey, good evening."
It was Yamazaki in a green plaid sport coat that sat oddly on his narrow shoulders. He blinked rapidly.
"Yamazaki.
You have met Rez, yes? Good, very good. A table is prepared to dine."
Yamazaki put two fingers inside the oversized buttoned collar of his cheap-looking white dress shirt and tugged, as though it were far too tight.
"I understand initial attempts to identify nodal points did not meet with success."
He swallowed. "I can't pull a personal fix out of something textured like corporate data. He's just not there." Rez was moving in the direction of whatever lay beyond the tank.
"Come,"
Yamazaki said, then lowered his voice.
"Something extraordinary. She is here. She dines with Rez. Reitowei."
The Eidaru. 24. Hotel Dai. In this tiny cab now with Masahiko and Gomi Boy, Masahiko up front on what should have been the driver's side, Gomi Boy beside her in the back. Gomi Boy had so many pockets in his fatigue pants and so many things in them that he had trouble getting comfortable. Chia had never been in a car this small, let alone a cab. Masahiko's knees were folded up almost against his chest. The driver had white cotton gloves and a hat like the hats cab drivers wore in 1940s movies. There were little covers made of starched white lace fixed to all the headrests with special clips. She guessed it was such a small cab because Gomi Boy was going to be paying cash money, and he made it clear he didn't have a lot of that. Somehow they had ascended out of the rain into this crazy, impressive, but old-fashioned-looking multi-level expressway, its steel bones ragged with bandages of Kevlar, and were whipping past the middle floors of tall buildings. Maybe that Shinjuku again, because there went that tin toy building, she thought, glimpsed through a gap, but far away and from another direction. And here, gone so fast she was never sure she'd seen him, through one window like all the rest, was a naked man cross-legged on an office desk, his mouth open as wide as possible, as if in a silent scream. Then she began to notice other buildings, through sheets of rain, and these were illuminated to a degree excessive even by local standards, like Nissan County attractions in a television ad, isolated theme park elements thrusting up out of a strata of more featureless structures, unmarked and unlit. Each bright building with its towering sign, Hotel King Midas with its twinkling crown and scepter, Freedom Shower Banff, with blue-green mountains flanking a waterfall of golden light. At least six more in rapid succession. Then Gomi Boy said something in Japanese. The driver's shiny black bill dipped in response. They swung onto an off-ramp, slowing. From the ramp's curve, in the flat, ugly flare of sodium floods, she saw a rainy, nowhere intersection, no cars in sight, where pale coarse grass lay wet and disheveled up a short, steep slope. No place at all, like it could as easily have been on the outskirts of Seattle, the outskirts of anywhere, and the homesickness made her gasp. Gomi Boy shot her a sidewise glance, engaged in the excavation of something from another of his pockets, this one apparently inside his pants. From somewhere well below the level of his crotch, he fished up a wallet-sized fold of paper money, secured with a wide black elastic band. In the passing glare of another road light, Chia saw him snap the elastic back and peel off three bills, bigger than American money, and on one, she made out the comfortingly familiar logo of a company whose name she'd known all her life. He tucked the three bills into the sleeve of his sweater and set about replacing the rest, wherever it was he kept it.
"There soon," he said, withdrawing his hand and refastening his suspenders.
"Where soon?"
They took a right and stopped. All around them, a strange white fairy glow, falling with the rain to oil-stained concrete neatly painted with two big white arrows side by side pointing in opposite directions. The one pointing in the direction they were headed indicated a square opening in a featureless white-painted concrete wall. 5-inch-wide ribbons of shiny pink plastic hung from its upper edge to the concrete below, concealing whatever was behind, and reminding Chia of streamers at a school dance. Gomi Boy gave the driver the three bills. He sat patiently waiting for change. Her legs cramping, Chia reached for the door handle, but Masahiko quickly reached across from the front, stopping her.
"Driver must open," he said. "If you open, mechanism breaks. Very expensive."
The driver gave Gomi Boy change. Chia thought Gomi Boy would tip him, but he didn't. The driver reached down and did something out of sight that made the door beside Chia open. She climbed out into the rain, dragging her bag after her, and looked up at the source of the white glow, a building like a wedding cake. Hotel Dai, spelled out in white neon script, edged with clear twinkling bulbs. Masahiko beside her now, urging her toward the pink ribbons. She heard the cab pull away behind her.
"Come,"
Gomi Boy with the plaid bag, ducking through the wet ribbons. Into an almost empty parking area, two small cars, one gray, one dark green, their license plates concealed by rectangles of smooth black plastic. A glass door sliding aside as Gomi Boy approached. A disembodied voice said something in Japanese. Gomi Boy answered.
"Give him your card," Masahiko said.
Chia took out the card and handed it to Gomi Boy, who seemed to be asking the voice a series of questions. Chia looked around. Pale blues, pink, light gray. A very small space that managed to suggest a hotel lobby without actually offering a place to sit down. Pictures cycling past on wall screens, interiors of very strange-looking rooms. The voice answering Gomi Boy's questions.
"He asks for a room with optimal porting capacity," Masahiko said quietly.
Gomi Boy and the voice seemed to reach agreement. He slotted Chia's card above something that looked like a small pink water fountain. The voice thanked him. A narrow hatch opened, and a key slid down into the pink bowl. Gomi Boy picked it up and handed it to Masahiko. Chia's card emerged from the slot. Gomi Boy pulled it out and passed it to Chia. He handed Masahiko the plaid bag, turned, and walked out, the glass door hissing open for him.
"He isn't coming with us?"
"Only two people allowed in room. He is busy elsewhere. Come."
Masahiko pointed toward an elevator that opened as they approached.
"What kind of hotel did you say this is?"
Chia got into the elevator. He stepped in behind her and the door closed. He cleared his throat.
"Love Hotel," he said.
"What's that?"
"Going up."
"Private rooms. For sex. Paid by the hour."
"Oh,"
Chia said, as though that explained everything. The elevator stopped and the door opened. He got out and she followed him along a narrow corridor lit with ankle-high light strips. He stopped in front of a door and inserted the key they'd been given. As he opened the door, lights came on inside.
"Have you been to one of these before?"
she asked, and felt herself blush. She hadn't meant it that way.
"No,"
he said. He closed the door behind her and examined the locks. He pushed two buttons.
"But people who come here sometimes wish to port. There is a reposting service that makes it very hard to trace. Also for phoning. Very secure."
Chia was looking at the round, pink, furry bed. It seemed to be upholstered in what they made stuffed animals out of. The wall-to-wall was shaggy and white as snow, the combination reminding her of a particularly nasty-looking sugar snack called a ring-ding. Velcro made that ripping sound. She turned to see Masahiko removing his nylon gaiters. He took off his black work shoes. The toe was out in one of his thin gray socks, and slid his feet into white paper sandals. Chia looked down at her own wet shoes on the white shag, and decided she'd better do the same.
"Why does this place look the way it does?"
she asked, kneeling to undo her laces.
Masahiko shrugged. Chia noticed that the quilted international biohazard symbol on the plaid bag was almost exactly the color of the fur on the bed. Spotting what was obviously the bathroom through an open door, she carried her own bag in there and closed the door behind her. The walls were upholstered with something black and shiny, and the floor was checkered with black and white tiles. Complicated mood lighting came on, and she was surrounded by ambient birdsong. This bathroom was nearly as big as the bedroom, with a bath like a miniature black swimming pool, and something else that Chia only gradually recognized as a toilet. Remembering the one back in Eddie's office, she put her bag down and approached the thing with extreme caution. It was black and chrome, and had arms and a back, sort of like a chair at the stylist's. There was a display cycling on a little screen beside it with fragments of English embedded in the Japanese. Chia watched as A, pleasure, and B, super pleasure, slid past. Uh-uh, she said. After studying the seat and the ominous black bowl, she lowered her pants, positioned herself strategically over the toilet, squatted carefully, and urinated without sitting down. She'd let someone else flush that one, she decided, while she washed her hands at the basin. But then she heard it flush itself. There was a glossy pink paper bag beside the basin with the words, Teen Teen Toiletry Bag, printed on it in swirly white script. It was sealed at the top with a silver stick-on bow. She removed the bow and looked inside. Lots of different little giveaway cosmetics, and at least a dozen different kinds of condoms, everything packaged to look more or less like candy. There was a shiny black cabinet to the left of the mirror above the basin, the only thing in the room that looked Japanese in that old-fashioned way. She opened it. A light came on inside, revealing three glass shelves, arranged with shrink-wrapped plastic models of guys' dicks, all different sizes of them, molded in weird colors. Other objects she didn't recognize at all. Knobby balls, something that looked like a baby's pacifier, miniature inner tubes with long rubbery whiskers. In the middle of it all stood a little black-haired doll in a pretty kimono made of bright paper and gold cloth. But when she tried to pick it up, the wig and the kimono came off in one piece, revealing yet another shrink-wrapped replica, this one with delicately painted eyes and a cupid's bow mouth. When she tried to put the wig and kimono back on, it fell over, knocking over everything on its shelf, so she closed the cabinet. Then she washed her hands again. Back in the ring-ding room, Masahiko was cabling his computer to a black console on a shelf full of entertainment gear. Chia put her bag on the bed. Something chimed softly, twice, and then the surface of the bed began to ripple, slow osmotic waves centering in on the bag, which began to rise slightly and fall. Ick, she said, and pulled the bag off the bed, which chimed again and began to subside. Masahiko glanced in her direction, but went back to whatever he was doing with the equipment on the shelf. Chia found that the room had a window, but it was hidden behind some kind of soft screen. She tried the clips that held the screen in place until she got the one that let her slide the screen aside on hidden tracks. The window looked out on a chain-linked parking lot beside a low beige building sided with corrugated plastic. There were three trucks parked there, the first vehicles she'd seen in Japan that weren't new or particularly clean. A wet-looking gray cat emerged from beneath one of the trucks and sprang into the shadow beneath another. It was still raining. Good, she heard Masahiko say, evidently satisfied. We go to Walled City. XXV. The Idoru.
How do you mean she's here? Laney asked Yamazaki as they rounded the rear of the Sherman tank. Clots of dry clay clung to the segments of its massive steel treads.
Mr. Kuwayama is here, Yamazaki whispered. He represents her.
Laney saw that several people were already seated at a low table. Two men, a woman. The woman must be Reitoe. If he'd anticipated her at all, it had been as some industrial-strength synthesis of Japan's last three dozen top female media faces. That was usually the way in Hollywood, and the formula tended to be even more rigid in the case of software agents. Eigenheads, Their features algorithmically derived from some human mean of proven popularity. She was nothing like that. Her black hair, rough cut and shiny, brushed pale bare shoulders as she turned her head. She had no eyebrows, and both her lids and lashes seemed to have been dusted with something white, leaving her dark pupils in stark contrast. And now her eyes met his. He seemed to cross a line. In the very structure of her face, in geometries of underlying bone, lay coded histories of dynastic flight, privation, terrible migrations. He saw stone tombs in steep alpine meadows, their lintels traced with snow. A line of shaggy pack ponies, their breath white with cold, followed a trail above a canyon. The curves of the river below were strokes of distant silver. Iron harness bells clanked in the blue dusk. Lainey shivered. In his mouth, a taste of rotten metal. The eyes of the Eidoru, envoy of some imaginary country, met his. "We're here," Arlie beside him, hand at his elbow. She was indicating two places at the table. "Are you all right?" she asked under her breath. "Take your shoes off." Lainey looked at Blackwell, who was staring at the Eidoru, something like pain in his face, but the expression vanished, sucked away behind the mask of his scars. Lainey did as he was told, kneeling and removing his shoes, moving as if he were drunk or dreaming, though he knew he was neither. And the Eidoru smiled, lit from within. "Lainey." The table was set above a depression in the floor. Lainey seated himself, arranging his feet beneath the table and gripping his cushion with both hands.
"What?"
"Are you okay?"
"Okay."
"You looked blind."
Rez was taking his place now at the head of the table, the Eidoru to his right. Someone else, Lainey saw that it was Lowe, the guitarist, to his left. Next to the Eidoru sat a dignified older man with rimless glasses, gray hair brushed back from his smooth forehead. He wore a very simple, very expensive-looking suit of some lusterless black material, and a high-collared white shirt that buttoned in a complicated way. When this man turned to address Ratoway, Lainey quite clearly saw the light of her face reflect for an instant in the almost circular lenses. Arlie's sharp intake of breath, she'd seen it too. A hologram. Something generated, animated, projected. He felt his grip relax slightly on the edges of the cushion. But then he remembered the stone tombs, the river, the ponies with their iron bells. Nodal. Lainey had once asked Gérald de Louvrier, the most patient of the tennis-playing Frenchmen of title, why it was that he, Lainey, had been chosen as the first, and as it would happen, the only recipient of the peculiar ability they sought to impart to him. He hadn't applied for the job, he said, and had no reason to believe the position had even been advertised. He had applied, he told de Louvrier, to be a trainee service rep. De Louvrier, with short, prematurely gray hair and a sun-table tan, leaned back in his articulated workstation chair and stretched his legs. He seemed to be studying his crepe-soled suede shoes. Then he looked out the window to rectangular beige buildings, anonymous, landscaping February snow.
"Do you not see how we do not teach you? We watch. We wish to learn from you."
They were in a Dat America research park in Iowa. There was an indoor court for de Louvrier and his colleagues, but they complained constantly about its surface.
"But why me?" De Louvrier's eyes looked tired. "We wish to be kind to the orphans. We are an unexpected warmth at the heart of Dat America."
He rubbed his eyes.
"No. Something was done to you, Lainey. In our way, perhaps. We seek to redress that."
"Is that a word? Redress?"
"No," Lainey said. "Do not question good fortune. You are here with us, doing work that matters. It is winter in this Iowa, true, but the work goes on."
He was looking at Lainey now.
"You are our only proof," he said.
"Of what?" De Louvrier closed his eyes.
"There was a man, a blind man,
who mastered echolocation. Clicks with the tongue, you understand? Eyes closed, he demonstrated. Like a bat. Fantastic. He opened his eyes. He could perceive his immediate environment in great detail. Ride a bicycle in traffic, always making the tick, tick. The ability was his, was absolutely real. And he could never explain it, never teach it to another. He wove his long fingers together and cracked his knuckles. We must hope that this is not the case with you. Don't think of a purple cow. Or was it a brown one? Lainey couldn't remember. Don't look at the Eideroo's face. She is not flesh. She is information. She is the tip of an iceberg. No, an Antarctica of information. Looking at her face would trigger it again. She was some unthinkable volume of information. She induced the nodal vision in some unprecedented way. She induced it as a narrative. He could watch her hand, watch the way she ate. The meal was elaborate, many small courses served on individual rectangular plates. Each time a plate was placed before Raithaway, and always within the field of whatever projected her, it was simultaneously veiled with a flawless copy. Hollow food on a hollow plate. Even the movement of her chopsticks brought on peripheral flickers of nodal vision, because the chopsticks were information, too. But nothing as dense as her features, her gaze. As each empty plate was removed, the untouched serving would reappear. But when the flickering began, Lainey would concentrate on his own meal, his clumsiness with his own chopsticks, conversation around the table. Kuwayama, the man with the rimless glasses, was answering something Rez had asked, though Lainey hadn't been able to catch the question itself. The result of an array of elaborate constructs that we refer to as desiring machines. Rez's green eyes, bright and attentive. Not in any literal sense, Kuwayama continued, but please envision aggregates of subjective desire. It was decided that the modular array would ideally constitute an architecture of articulated longing. The man's voice was beautifully modulated, his English accented in a way that Lainey found impossible to place. Rez smiled then, his eyes going to the face of the Eideroo, as did Lainey's as well, automatically. He fell through her eyes. He was staring up at a looming cliff face that seemed to consist entirely of small rectangular balconies, none set at quite the same level or depth. Orange sunset off a tilted steel-framed window, oil-slick colors crawling in the sky. He closed his eyes, looked down, opened them. A fresh plate there, more food. You're really into your meal, Arlie said. A concentrated effort with the chopsticks, and he managed to capture and swallow something that was like a 1-inch cube of cold chutney omelet. Wonderful. Don't want any of that fugu, though. Blowfish with the neurotoxin? Heard about that? You've already had seconds, she said. Remember the big plate of raw fish arranged like the petals of a chrysanthemum? You're kidding, Lainey said. Lips and tongue feel faintly numb. That's it. Lainey ran his tongue across his lips. Was she kidding? Yamazaki, seated to his left, leaned close. There may be a way around the problem you face with Rez's data. You are aware of low-res global fan activity.
Of what?
Many fans. They report each sighting of Rez, Low, other musicians involved. There is much incidental detail.
Lainey knew from his day's video education that low-res were theoretically a duo, but that there were always at least two other members, usually more. And Rez had been adamant from the start about his dislike of drum machines. The current drummer, Blind Willie Jude, seated opposite Yamazaki, had been with them for years. He'd been turning his enormous black glasses in the Eideroo's direction throughout the meal. Now he seemed to sense Lainey's glance. The black glasses, video units, swung around.
Man, Jude said. Rosa's sitting down there making eyes at a big aluminum thermos bottle.
You can't see her?
Holos are hard, man.
The drummer said, touching his glasses with a fingertip.
Take my kids to Nissan County. I'll call ahead, get them tweaked around a little. Then I can see them. But this lady's on a funny frequency or something. All I can see is the projector and this kinda ectoplastic, right? Glow-like.
The man seated between Jude and Mr. Kuwayama, whose name was Ozaki, bobbed apologetically in Jude's direction.
We regret this very much. We regret deeply.
A slight adjustment is required, but it cannot be done at this time.
Hey, Jude said. No big problem. I've seen her already. I get all the music channels with these. That one where she's a Mongol princess or something up in the mountains.
Lainey lost a chopstick.
The most recent single,
Ozaki said.
Yeah, Jude said. That's pretty good. She wears that gold mask. Okay, shit.
He popped a section of maki into his mouth and chewed. Haknam. Chia and Masahiko sat facing one another on the white carpet. The room's only chair was a fragile-looking thing with twisted wire legs and a heart-shaped seat upholstered in pink metal-flake plastic. Neither of them wanted to sit on the bed. Chia had her sandbenders across her knees and was working her fingers into her tip set. Masahiko's computer was on the carpet in front of him. He'd put its control face back on and peeled a very compact pair of tip sets out of the back of the cube, along with two small black oval cups on fine lengths of optical cable. Another length of the cable ran from his computer to a small open hatch at the back of the sandbenders.
Okay, Chia said, settling the last of her tips. Let's go. I've got to get hold of somebody.
Yes, he said. He picked up the black cups, one in either hand, and placed them over his eyes. When he let go, they stayed there. It looked uncomfortable. Chia reached up and pulled her own glasses down over her eyes.
What do I...
Something at the core of things moved simultaneously in mutually impossible directions. It wasn't even like porting. Software conflict? Faint impression of light through a fluttering of rags. And then the thing before her. Building or biomass. Or cliff face, looming there, in countless unplanned strata, nothing about it even or regular. A accreted patchwork of shallow, random balconies, thousands of small windows throwing back blank silver rectangles of fog, stretching either way to the periphery of vision, and on the high, uneven crest of that ragged facade, a black fur of twisted pipe, antennas sagging under vine growth of cable. And past this scribbled border, a sky where colors crawled like gasoline on water.
Haknam, he said beside her. What is it?
City of darkness, between the walls of the world.
She remembered the scarf she'd seen in his room behind the kitchen, its intricate map of something chaotic and compacted, tiny irregular segments of red and black and yellow. And then they were moving forward, toward a narrow opening.
It's a mud, right?
Something like a larger, permanent version of the site the Tokyo chapter had erected for the meeting, or the tropical forest Kelsey and Zona had put up. But people played games in muds. They made up characters for themselves and pretended. Little kids did it, and lonely people.
No, he said. Not a game.
They were inside now, smoothly accelerating, and the squirming density of the thing was continual visual impact, an optical drumming. Taichung Street. Walls scrawled and crawling with scrolling messages, spectral doorways passing like cards in a shuffled deck. And they were not alone. Others there, ghost figures whipping past, and everywhere the sense of eyes. Fractal filth, bit rot. The corridor of their passage tented with crazy swoops of faintly flickering lines of some kind. Almshouse back street. A sharp turn. Another. Then they were ascending a maze of twisting stairwells, still accelerating, and Chia took a deep breath and closed her eyes. Retinal fireworks bursting there. But the pressure was gone. When she opened her eyes, they were in a much cleaner, but no larger version of his room behind the kitchen in the restaurant. No empty ramen bowls, no piles of clothing. He was beside her on the sleeping ledge, staring at the shifting patterns on his computer's control face. Beside it, on the work surface, her sand vendors. The texture mapping was rudimentary, everything a little too smooth and glossy. She looked at him, curious to see how he'd present. A basic scan job. Maybe a year out of date, his hair was shorter. He wore the same black tunic. On the wall behind the computers was an animated version of the printed scar, its red, black, and yellow bits pulsing slightly. A bright green line traced a route in from the perimeter, where it ended bright green. Concentric rings radiated from one particular yellow square. She looked back at him, but he was still staring at the control face. Something chimed. She glanced at the door, which was mapped in a particularly phony-looking wood grain effect, and saw a small white rectangle slide under the door, and keep sliding, straight toward her across the floor to vanish under the sleeping ledge. She looked down in time to see it rise at exactly the same rate up the edge of the striped mattress and over, coming to a halt where it was in optimum position to be read. It was in that same font they'd used at Whiskey Clone, or one just like it. It said, Ku Klux Klan Collectibles, and then some letters and numbers that didn't look like any kind of address she knew. Another chime. She looked at the door in time to see a gray blur scoot from under it, flat, whirling, fast. It was on the white rectangle now, something like the shadow of a crab or spider, two-dimensional and multi-legged. It swallowed it, shot for the door. I have completed responsibility to Walled City, Masahiko said, turning from the control face.
What were those things? She asked him.
What things?
Like a business card, crawled under the door. Then another thing like a gray cut-out crab that ate it.
An advertisement, he decided, and a subprogram that offered criticism.
It didn't offer criticism. It ate it.
Perhaps the person who wrote the subprogram dislikes advertising. Many do. Or dislikes the advertiser. Political, aesthetic, personal reasons. All are possible.
Chia looked around at the reproduction of his tiny room.
Why don't you have a bigger site?
Instantly worried that it was because he was Japanese. And maybe they were just used to that. But still, it was about the smallest virtual space she could remember having been in. And it wasn't like a bigger one cost more, not unless you were like Zona and wanted yourself a whole country.
The Walled City is a concept of scale. Very important. Scale is place, yes? 33,000 people inhabited original, 2.7 hectares, as many as 14 stories.
None of which made any sense to Chia.
I have to pour it, okay?
Of course, he said, and gestured toward her sand vendors. She was braced for that two directions at once thing, but it didn't happen. The bitmapped fish were swimming around in the glass coffee table. She looked out the window at the crayon trees and wondered where the Mumphalumphagus was. She hadn't seen it for a while. It was something her father had made for her when she was a baby. A big pink dinosaur with goofy eyelashes. She checked the table for mail, but there was nothing new. She could phone from here. Call her mother. Sure.
Hi, I'm in Tokyo in a love hotel. People are after me because somebody put something in my bag, so what do you think I should do?
She tried porting to Kelsey's address instead. But all she got was that annoying marble anteroom and the voice, not Kelsey's, that said that Kelsey Van Troyer wasn't in at the moment. Chia exited without leaving a message. The next address she tried was Zona's, but Zona's provider was down. That happened a lot in Mexico, and particularly in Mexico City, where Zona lived. She decided to try Zona's secret place, because it was on a mainframe in Arizona, and it was never down. She knew Zona didn't like people just showing up there because Zona didn't want the company that had built the original website and then forgotten about it to discover that Zona had gotten in and set up her own country. She asked the sand vendors where she was porting from now, and it said Helsinki, Finland. So that reporting capability at the hotel was working at least. Just before twilight at Zona's, like always, Chia scanned the floor of a dry swimming pool looking for Zona's lizards, but she didn't see them. Usually they were right there waiting for you, but not this time. Zona. Chia looked up, wondering if she'd see those spooky condor things that Zona kept. The sky was beautiful, but empty. Originally, that sky had been the most important part of this place, and no expense had been spared. Serious sky, deep and clean, and a crazy Mexican shade, like pale turquoise. They'd brought people here to sell them airplanes, corporate jets, when the jets were still in the design phase. There had been a white concrete landing strip, but Zona had folded it up into a canyon and mapped over it. All the local color was Zona stuff, the cooking fires and the dead pools and the broken walls. She'd imported landscape files, maybe even real stuff she knew from somewhere in Mexico.
Zona!
Something rattled up the nearest ridge, like pebbles on a sheet of metal. It's okay. One of the lizards. She's just not here now. A twig snapped. Closer. Don't fuck around, Zona. But she exited. The bitmapped fish swam back and forth. That had been very creepy. She wasn't sure why exactly, but it had been. Still was, kind of. She looked at the door to her bedroom and found herself wondering what she'd find there if she gestured for it. The bed, her low-res skyline poster, the agent of Lowe greeting her in his mindless, friendly way. But what if she found something else? Something waiting. Like she could still hear that rattle up the slope. Or what if she went to the wire-framed door where her mother's room would have been? What if she opened it and her mother's room was there after all, and not her mother waiting, but something else? She was creeping herself out, that was all. She looked at her stack of low-res albums beside the lithographed lunchbox, her virtual Venice beside that. Even her music master would seem like company now. She opened it, watching the piazza decompress like some incredibly intricate paper pop-up book on fast-forward, facades and colonnades springing up around her, with the hour before a winter's dawn for backlight. Turning from the water where the prows of black gondolas bobbed like marks in some lost system of musical notation, she lifted her finger and shot forward into the maze, thinking as she did that this place had been as strange in its way as Masahiko's walled city. And what was that all supposed to be about anyway? And it was only as she crossed her third bridge that she noticed that he wasn't there. Hey! She stopped. A shop window displayed the masks of carnival, the really ancient ones. Black, penis-nosed leather, empty eye holes, a mirror draped with yellowed crepe. Checking the sandbenders to make sure she hadn't turned him off. She hadn't. Chia closed her eyes and counted to three, made herself feel the carpeted floor she sat on in the Hotel Don. She opened her eyes. At the end of the narrow Venetian street, down the tilted, stepped cobbles where it opened out into a small square or plaza, an unfamiliar figure stood beside the central fountain. She pulled the goggles off without bothering to close Venice. Masahiko sat opposite her, his legs crossed, the black cups sucked up against his eyes. His lips were moving silently, and his hands on his knees in their black tip sets traced tiny finger patterns in the air. Mary Alice was sitting on the furry pink bed with an unlit cigarette in her mouth. She had a little square, gray gun in her hand, and Chia saw how the freshly glossed red of her nails contrasted with the pearly plastic of the handle. "Start it again," Mary Alice said around the cigarette. She pulled the trigger, causing a small golden flame to spring up from the muzzle, and used it to light her cigarette. "Tokyo, I'll tell you. Does it every time." 27. That physical thing. Laney was at a black rubber urinal in the men's when he noticed the Russian combing his hair in the mirror. At least it looked like black rubber with sort of floppy edges. They obviously had the plumbing working, but he wondered what they'd say if you asked to make your own contribution to the grotto. On his way here, he'd noticed that one of the bars was topped with a slab of something murky green and translucent, lit from below, and he'd hoped they hadn't made that from what they'd sawn out of the stairwell. Dinner was over, and he'd probably had too much sake with it. He and Arlie and Yamazaki had watched Rez meeting this new version of the Eideru, the one Willie Jude saw as a big silver thermos. And Blackwell was having to get used to that, because Laney guessed that the bodyguard hadn't had any idea she'd be here, not until he'd walked in and Rez had told him. Arlie had talked with Lowe through most of it, mainly about real estate, different properties he owned around the world. Lainey had listened to more of Yamazaki's ideas about accessing this teenage fan club stuff, and there might actually be something to that, but they'd have to try it to find out. Blackwell hadn't said two words to anybody, drinking lager instead of sake, and packing his food away as though he were trying to plug something, some gap in security that could be taken care of if you stuffed it methodically with enough sashimi. The Australian was an ace with chopsticks. He could probably stick one in your eye at 50 paces. But the main show had been Rez and the Idoru, and to a lesser extent, Kuwayama, who'd carried on long conversations with them both. The other one, Ozaki, seemed to be the guy they brought along in case someone had to change the batteries in the silver thermos. And Willie Jude was amiable enough, but in about as content-free a way as possible. Texts were supposed to be an easy source of whatever passed for gossip in a given company, so Lainey had tried a few openings in that direction. But Ozaki hadn't said any more than he'd had to. And since Lainey couldn't get right away within his field of vision without starting to slide over into a nodal mode, he'd had to conduct his evening's eavesdropping with whatever pickup visuals were available. Arlie wasn't too bad for that. There was something about the line of her jaw that he particularly liked, and kept coming back to. Lainey zipped up and went to wash his hands. The basin made of that same floppy-looking black stuff, and noticed that the Russian was still combing his hair. Lainey had no way of knowing if the man was literally Russian or not, but he thought of him that way because of the black patent paratrooper boots with contrasting white stitching, the pants with the black silk ribbon down the side, and the white leather evening jacket. Either Russian, or one of those related jobs, but very definitely combinat inflected, that mutant, commie mafioso thing. The Russian was combing his hair with a total concentration that made Lainey think of a fly grooming itself with its front feet. He was very large, and had a large head, though it was mainly in the vertical, quite tall from the eyebrows up, seeming to taper very slightly toward the crown. For all the attention being given to the combing, the man didn't actually have much hair, not on top anyway, and Lainey had thought these guys all went in for implants. Rydell had told him combinat types were all over Tokyo. Rydell had seen a documentary about it, how they were so singularly and surrealistically brutal that nobody wanted to mess with them. Then Rydell had started to tell him about two Russians, San Francisco cops of some kind, who he'd had some sort of run-in with. But Lainey had to take a meeting with Rice Daniels and a makeup artist and never heard the end of it. Lainey checked to see that he didn't have anything stuck in his teeth from dinner. As he went out, the Russian was still combing. He saw Yamazaki blinking and looking lost. "It's back there," he said.
"What is?"
"The can."
"Can?"
"Men's. The toilet."
"But I was looking for you."
"You found me."
"I observed as we ate that you avoided looking directly at the Idoru."
"Right."
"I surmise that density of information is sufficient to allow nodal apprehension."
"You got it." Yamazaki nodded.
"Ah, but this would not be the case with one of her videos, or even with a live performance."
"Why not?" Lainey had started back in the direction of their table.
"Bandwidth,"
Yamazaki said.
"The version here tonight is high bandwidth prototype."
"Are we compensated for beta testing?"
"Can you describe the nature of nodal apprehension, please?"
"Like memories," Lainey said. "Or clips from a movie. But something the drummer said made me think I was just seeing her latest video." Someone shoved Lainey out of the way from behind, and he fell across the nearest table, breaking a glass. He felt the glass shatter under him, and found himself staring straight down for a second into the taut gray latex lap of a woman who screamed explosively just before the table gave way. Something, probably her knee, clipped him hard in the side of the head. He managed to get to his knees, holding his head, and found himself recalling an experiment they'd done in science back in Gainesville. Surface tension. You sprinkled pepper over the water in a glass, brought the tip of a needle close to the film of pepper, watched it spring back from the needle, like a live thing. And he saw that happening here, his head ringing. But instead of pepper, it was the crowd in the Western world, and he knew that the needle must be pointed at Rez's table. The back of a white leather evening jacket.
But then he saw the Sherman tank come unmoored on the shoulders of the recoiling crowd, spinning toward him, huge and weightless. And the lights went out. The crowd had been screaming anyway, but the dark twisted the communal pitch up into something that had Laney covering his ears. Or trying to, because someone stumbled into him and he went over backward, instinctively curling into a tight fetal knot and clamping his hands across the back of his neck.
"Hey," said a voice very close to his ear. "Get on up. You're gonna get stepped on."
It was Willie Jude.
"I can see." A hand around his wrist. "Got in for a red."
Laney let the drummer pull him to his feet.
"What is it? What's happening?"
"Dunno, but come on. Gonna get worse."
As if on cue, a terrible squeal of raw animal pain cut through the frenzied crowd noise.
"Blackwell got one,"
Willie Jude said, and Laney felt the drummer's hand grip his belt. He stumbled as he was pulled along. Someone ran into him, shouted in Japanese. After that, he kept his hands up, trying to protect his face, and went where the drummer pulled him. Suddenly, they were in a cove or pocket of relative quiet.
"Where are we?"
Laney asked.
"This way."
Something clipped Laney across the shins.
"Stool,"
Willie Jude said.
"Sorry."
Glass snapped beneath Laney's shoes. A curve of greenish light, broken cursive, hanging in the dark. Another few steps, and he saw the grotto. Willie Jude let go of his belt.
"You can see here, right? That bioluminescent stuff?"
"Yeah," Laney said. "Thanks."
"It doesn't register on my glasses. I get infrared off warm bodies, but I can't make out the steps. Walk me down."
He took Laney's hand. They started down the stairs together. A black-clad trio of Japanese shot past them, leaving a high-heeled pump on the encrusted stairs, and vanished around the landing. Laney kicked the shoe out of Willie Jude's way and kept going. When they rounded the corner at the landing, Arlie was there, a green champagne bottle cocked over her shoulder. There was a smear of blood at the corner of her mouth, darker than her lipstick. When she saw Laney, she lowered the bottle.
"Where were you?"
she said.
"The men's," Laney said.
"You missed the show.
What happened?"
"Damn it," she said. "My coat's up there."
"Keep moving, keep moving,"
Willie Jude said. More stairs, more landings, the rippling walls of the grotto giving way to concrete. People kept rushing down past them, knots and singles, taking the stairs too fast. Laney rubbed his ribs where he'd come down on the glass. It hurt, but somehow he hadn't been cut.
"They look like combinat," Arlie said. "Big ugly guys, bad outfits. I couldn't tell if they were after Rez or the Ida Room. Like they just thought they could walk in and do it."
"Do what?"
"Dunno,"
she said.
"Kuyama had at least a dozen of his own security people at the two closest tables. And Blackwell probably prays for a scene like that every night before he goes to bed. He reached into his jacket, then the lights went out."
"He put 'em out," Willie Jude said. "Some kind of remote. He can see better in the dark than I can with these infrareds. Don't know how that is, but he can."
"How'd you get out?"
Laney asked Arlie.
"Flashlight in my purse."
"Laney-san." Looking back to see Yamazaki, one sleeve of his green plaid coat pulled free at the shoulder, his glasses missing a lens. Arlie had taken a phone from her purse and was cursing softly as she tried to get it to work. Yamazaki caught up with him at the next landing. The four of them continued down together, Laney still holding the blind drummer's hand. When they reached the street, the Western World's sullen crew of door people were nowhere in sight. A single policeman with a plastic rain cover on his cap was muttering frantically into a microphone clipped to the front of his rain cape. He was walking in tight circles as he did this, gesturing dramatically with a white baton at nothing in particular. Several kinds of alien siren were converging on the Western World, and Laney thought he could hear a helicopter. Willie Jude dropped Laney's hand and adjusted his video goggles to the street's light level.
"Where's my car?"
Arlie lowered her phone, which apparently was working now.
"You'd better come with us, Willie. Some kind of tactical unit is on the way."
"Nothing like it,"
Rez said, and Laney turned to see the singer emerging from the Western World, brushing something white from his dark jacket.
"That physical thing. Too much time in the virtual, we forget that, don't we? You're Laner?"
Extending his hand.
"Laney,"
Laney said. as Arlie's dark green van pulled up beside them.
28. A matter of credit. Mary Alice opened a curved drawer that was built into the pink bed's headboard. She was wearing a black skirt suit with big red Ashley Modine Carter-style sequin roses on the lapels. She took out a little blue glass dish and balanced it on her knee.
I hate these places, she said. There's lots of ways to make sex ugly, but it's kind of hard to make it look this ridiculous.
She knocked the gray end off her cigarette into the blue saucer.
How old are you anyway?
14, Chia said.
About what I told him. You're 14, 15 for real. And no way you were onto me.
I was onto you, right?
It was my move. I planned it on you. But they don't believe me. Say you're some kind of operator. Say I'm just stupid. Say that Rez guy sent you to SeaTac to get the stuff. Say you're a setup, and I'm crazy to believe a kid couldn't do that.
She sucked on the cigarette, squinting.
Where is it?
She looked down at Chia's bag, open on the white carpet.
There?
I didn't mean to take it. I didn't know it was there.
I know that, Mary Alice said. What I told him. I meant to get it back off you at the club.
I don't understand any of this, Chia said. It just scares me.
Sometimes I bring stuff back for Eddie. Party favors for the club. It's illegal. But it's not all that illegal, you know. Not hard stuff, really. But this time he was doing something else on the side. Something with the Russians, and I didn't like it. That's what scares me, that stuff. Like it's alive.
What stuff?
That. Assemblers, they're called.
Chia looked at her bag.
That thing in my bag is a nanotech assembler?
More like what you start with. Kind of an egg or a little factory. You plug that thing into another machine that programs them, and they start building themselves out of whatever's handy. And when there's enough of them, they start building whatever it was you wanted them to. There's some kind of law against selling that stuff to the Combinat, so they want it bad. But Eddie worked out a way to do it. I met these two creepy German guys in the SeaTac Hyatt. They'd flown in there from wherever. I figured maybe Africa.
She mashed the lit end of the cigarette into the little blue dish, making it smell even worse.
They didn't want to give it to me because they were expecting Eddie. Lot of back and forth on the phone. Finally, they did. I was supposed to put it in the suitcase with the other stuff, but it made me nervous. Made me want to self-medicate.
She looked around the room. She put the blue dish with the crushed cigarette on a square black side table and did something that made the front of it open. It was a refrigerator filled with little bottles. Mary Alice bent over, peering in there. The pistol-shaped lighter slid off the pink bed.
No tequila,
Mary Alice said.
You tell me why anybody'd name a vodka Comeback Salmon.
Removing a little square bottle with a fish on its side.
Japanese would, though.
She looked down at the lighter.
Like a Russian would make a cigarette lighter that looks like a pistol.
Chia saw that Mary Alice didn't have her hair extensions in anymore.
When they were taking DNA samples in SeaTac, Chia said, you stuck the end of your extension in there.
Mary Alice cracked the seal on the little bottle, opened it, drained it in a single gulp, and shivered.
Those extensions are all my own hair, she said. Grew 'em out when I was on sort of a health diet, understand? They catch people doing recreationals when they take those hair samples. Some recreationals, they stay in your hair a long time.
Mary Alice put the empty bottle down beside the blue dish.
What's he doing?
Pointing at Masahiko.
Porting,
Chia said, unable to think of a quick way to explain the walled city.
I can see that. You came here 'cause these places will repost, right?
But you found us anyway.
I got connections with the cab company. I figured it was worth a try. But the Russians will think of it, too, if they haven't already.
But how do you get in? It was all locked.
I know my way around these places, honey. I know my way entirely too well.
Masahiko removed the black cups that covered his eyes, saw Mary Alice, looked down at the cups, then back up at Chia.
Mary Alice, Chia said.
Gomi Boy presented like a life-size anime of himself, huge eyes and even taller hair.
Who drank the vodka?
He asked.
Mary Alice,
Chia said.
Who's Mary Alice?
She's in the room at the hotel,
Chia said.
That was the equivalent of 20 minutes porting,
Gomi Boy said.
How can there be someone in your room at the hotel Dai?
It's complicated, Chia said.
They were back in Masahiko's room in the walled city. They'd just clicked back, none of that maze running like the first time, past an icon reminding her she'd left her Venice open, but too late for that. Maybe once you were in here, you got back fast. But Masahiko'd said they had to, quick, there was trouble. Mary Alice had said she didn't mind, but Chia didn't like it at all that Mary Alice was in the room with them while they were porting.
Your cash card is good for 26 more minutes of room time, Gomi Boy said, unless your friend hits the minibar again. Do you have an account in Seattle?
No, Chia said. Just my mother.
We've already looked at that, Masahiko said.
Your mother's credit would not sustain rental of the room plus porting charges. Your father...
My father?
Has an expense account with his employer in Singapore. A merchant bank.
How do you know that?
Gomi Boy shrugged.
Walled City. We find things out. There are people here who know things.
You can't tap into my father's account, Chia said.
It's for his job.
25 minutes remaining, Masahiko said. Chia pulled her goggles off. Mary Alice was taking another miniature bottle from the little fridge.
Don't open that!
Mary Alice gave a guilty little shriek and dropped the bottle.
Just maybe some rice crackers,
she said.
Nothing,
Chia said.
It's too expensive. We're running out of money.
Oh,
Mary Alice said, blinking.
Right. I don't have any, though. Eddie's cut my cards off, for sure. And the first time I plug one, he'll know exactly where I am.
Masahiko spoke to Chia without removing the eye cup.
We have your father's expense account online.
Mary Alice smiled.
What we like to hear, right?
Chia was pulling off her tip set.
You'll have to take it to them,
she said to Mary Alice.
The nano thing. I'll give it to you now. You take it to them, give it to them. Tell them it was all a mistake.
She scooted on her hands and knees over to where her bag sat open on the floor. She dug for the thing, found it, held it out to Mary Alice in what was left of the blue and yellow bag from the SeaTac duty-free. The dark gray plastic and the rows of little holes made it look like some kind of deformed designer pepper grinder.
Take it. Explain to them. Tell them it was just a mistake.
Mary Alice cringed.
Put it back, okay?
She swallowed.
See, the problem isn't whether or not there's been a mistake. The problem's they'll kill us now anyway because we know about it. And Eddie, he'll let 'em, 'cause he has to. And 'cause he's just sort of generally fed up with me, the ungrateful little greasy shithead motherfucker.
Mary Alice shook her head sadly.
It's about the end of our relationship, you ask me.
Account accessed, Masahiko said. Join us here now, please. You have another visitor. 29. Her bad side. Arlie's van smelled of long-chain monomers and warm electronics. The rear seats had been removed to make room for the collection of black consoles, cabled together and wedged into place with creaking wads of bubble pack. Rez rode up front beside the driver, the ponytailed Japanese Californian from Akihabara. Lainey squatted on a console between Arlie and Yamazaki, with Willie Jude and the red-haired tech behind them. Lainey's ribs hurt where he'd come down on the table, and that seemed to be getting worse. He discovered that the top of his left sock was sticky with blood, but he wasn't sure where it had come from, or even if it was his own. Arlie had her phone pressed to her ear.
Option 8,
she said, evidently to the driver, who touched the pad beside the dashboard map. Lainey glimpsed Tokyo grid segments whipping past on the screen.
We're taking Rez back with us.
Take me to the Imperial, Rez said.
Blackwell's orders, Arlie said.
Let me talk to him, reaching back for the phone. They swung left into a wider street, their lights picking out a small crowd speed-walking away from the Western world, all of them trying to look as though they just happened to be there out for a brisk stroll. The neighborhood was nondescript and generically urban, and, aside from the guilty-looking speedwalkers, quite deserted.
Keithy, Rez said. I want to go back to the hotel.
The terrible white day star of a police helicopter swept over them, carbon black shadows speeding away across concrete. Rez was listening to the phone. They passed an all-night noodle wagon, its interior ghostly behind curtains of yellowed plastic, images flicking past on a small screen behind the counter. Arlie nudged Lainey's knee, pointed past Rez's shoulder. A trio of white armored cars shot through the approaching intersection, blue lights flashing on their rectangular turrets, and vanished without a sound. Rez turned, handing the phone back to her.
Keithy's being his paracel. He wants me to go to your hotel and wait for him.
Arlie took the phone.
Does he know what it was about?
Autograph hunters?
Rez started to turn back around in his seat. What happened to the Ida room? Lainey asked.
Rez peered at him.
If you kidnapped that new platform, and I thought it was wonderful, what exactly would you have?
I don't know.
Ray's only reality is the realm of ongoing serial creation, Rez said. Entirely processed. Infinitely more than the combined sum of her various selves. The platforms sink beneath her one after another as she grows denser and more complex.
The long green eyes seemed to grow dreamy in the light of passing storefront.
And then the singer turned away.
Lainey watched Arlie dab at the cut corner of her mouth with a tissue.
Lainey-san.
Yamazaki, a whisper, putting something into his hand. A cabled set of iPhones.
We have global fan activity database.
His ribs hurt.
Was his leg bleeding?
Later, okay?
Arlie's suite was at least twice as large as Lainey's room. It had its own miniature sitting room, separated from the bedroom and bath with gilded French doors. The four chairs in the sitting room had very tall, very narrow backs, each one tapering to a rendition of the L-Pat done in sandblasted steel. These chairs were quite amazingly uncomfortable, and Lainey was hunched forward on one now, in considerable pain, hugging his bruised ribs. The blood in his sock had turned out to be his own, from a skinned patch on his left shin. He'd plastered it over with micropore from the professional-looking first aid kit in Arlie's bathroom. He doubted there was anything there for his ribs, but he was wondering if some kind of elastic bandage might help. End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.